Ethics Untangled is made by the Idea Centre at the University of Leeds. It's a podcast about the difficult ethical questions we face in everyday life. In each episode, I interview someone, usually a philosopher, who's spent time thinking through one of these questions, and we try between us to work out what's going on. Heather Widdows is a professor in the Department of Philosophy at Warwick, with expertise in applied ethics, global ethics, bioethics, moral philosophy and feminist philosophy. She's interested in the demands that the beauty ideal places on people, particularly women. Her book Perfect Me was described as groundbreaking by Vogue and listed by The Atlantic as one of the best books of 2018. In it, she argues that beauty is now an ethical ideal. Not only are women held to an impossible standard, but failure to live up to that standard is seen as a failure of moral character. In the interview, we talked about several topics connected to beauty, including whether it's reasonable to expect women to refuse to conform to the beauty ideal, and what other effective responses there might be. We also talked about Heather's idea of lookism, a form of discrimination based on looks, comparable to sexism or racism.
So, Heather, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
So we're going to be talking about beauty and beauty as an ideal and specifically a moral ideal in this conversation. But first of all, I wondered if you could just say something about why we should care about this. Like, why is this something that we should take seriously as an issue?
We should take it seriously because it's completely transforming what we can be and do. So you might think, oh, it's only young girls that this is affecting. It's only young girls who, you know, won't go out if they're having a bad hair day or if they won't speak up in class. But actually, increasingly, it's all of us shaping how we feel about ourselves, shaping what we do with our time. How often do we make decisions about what we're going to do in our week, around whether or not we can get to the gym or not? When we think about our New Year's resolutions, it's what we want for ourselves. So we used to think that beauty was trivial, and some people still do, but increasingly it really is one of the ways that we shape our lives and we define ourselves. And it's in a way quite surprising why we haven't taken this seriously. So the question really might be, why on earth have we not taken this seriously, rather than why is it we should now take it seriously?
Right, okay. And you think it's something that we should take seriously, but also something that we should actually be concerned about, right? So it's something that has potentially negative effects.
I do think that. I think we have an epidemic of body image anxiety, and everybody always talks about we have an epidemic of this and an epidemic of that. But when you look at it, it crosses continents, it crosses demographics. It doesn't matter whether you're rich, whether you're poor. Nearly everybody is more and more concerned with how they look, saying something about who they are. And worse, they're feeling like they don't measure up. Now, some of that's connected to social media and to the fact that our peer group is now not the people that we grew up with or the people in our class, but almost the whole world. But some of it is just connected to the way that we're moving into a more visual culture, a more image-based culture. And then we're looking at these increasingly doctored and perfect images, finding ourselves wanting and therefore feeling like we're failures. And that's deeply impacting on our mental health, our physical health, and changing what we do. We're increasingly engaging in very risky behaviours in order to attain this ideal and actually impossible body. So the harms are extensive. And I really don't think I'm exaggerating when I say epidemic. I actually think we should think about it more like smoking as a public health issue and less about what individuals are choosing to do with their bodies.
Right, okay. So do you think that the cause of this is this kind of image-saturated culture that we live in then? Because we're kind of, everybody always uses the word bombarded. We're bombarded with images, as you say, of kind of unattainable beautiful bodies, but we're also through social media kind of encouraged to present ourselves in a kind of image-based way, right?
The move to a visual culture and the image-based nature of our culture is definitely a key part of how we're feeling like this. And actually, I think that's something that academics and policymakers, we haven't really understood just how profound the change is from a text-based to a visual-based culture. Images don't function like words. They cut through some of the right ways that we try and push back against them. So even though we know that nobody looks like their Instagram profile, it still doesn't mean that we don't evaluate our actual failing bodies against the perfect bodies we see on Instagram. And that's not about lack of knowledge, which is one of the reasons that lots of things we do don't work, because we know, but yet it doesn't mean that we don't feel like we're not measuring up. So social media, image-based culture, definitely a key factor in why this has become important, but not the only factor. There are other factors, and it's quite hard to unpick. So in Perfect Me, which is my book on this, I talk about a sort of perfect storm of drivers. One is, of course, visual culture, and perhaps that's more important than I gave it credit for at the time I was writing. It's also something about the technical possibilities. So it used to be the case that there wasn't very much we could do to meet that kind of impossible standard, but we have so many more treatments and tweakments and surgeries that actually we can make interventions in our bodies, and then we can also make interventions in our images with filters and digital tech. So there's ways in which we're changing stuff. There's also, something about the way we're doing consumption and building ourselves. So it used to be the case we'd show our status with the it car or the it bag or something else. Increasingly, we're trying to show who we are by how our bodies are. So you see a real sort of strange phenomenon about, I'm a good mother if somehow I get back my, pre-pregnancy body 8 weeks after birth, as if that's going to say anything about whether I'm a good mother or not. So there's all kinds of things in the mix, but visual culture and the proliferation of images, definitely part of it.
Sure, yeah. And your suggestion is not just that beauty is an ideal that people try and struggle to live up to, but that it's an ethical ideal. So could you say a bit more about what you mean by that?
Absolutely. So if it was just a social norm, something that we kind of expected to do, but that doesn't have the kind of weight as a moral ideal, I think it would be much easier to push back on it. There are all kinds of norms that women, for instance, have pushed back against in the feminist movement. So norms of women not working outside the home, norms of women not doing certain professions, right? Social norms, it doesn't mean that they don't shape what we do, but they don't have the kind of weightiness that a moral norm does. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense in when we don't live up to a moral norm, it's not that we just think we fail to do something that other people expect or that we normally do, but something that we feel we've done something wrong by, that we're bad, that we failed. So that's why if you don't understand that beauty is an ethical ideal, it's hard to understand why people would continue to engage in what are sometimes very harmful practices, or why they feel so bad when either they're body shamed by others, told that they don't measure up, or they look at themselves and feel like they're failures. If it was just about a social norm, it doesn't mean you wouldn't feel it, but you wouldn't feel it in quite the same way. You wouldn't feel that shame of the self. You wouldn't feel like you were a failure.
Yeah, and a lot of the language we use around beauty is kind of ethically loaded language, right? Like, oh, I've been good, I haven't had that extra piece of cake or whatever.
Absolutely saturated with morality. So beauty talk is moral talk, exactly. The naughty piece of cake, the being good to the gym, but also some of the language around, you're worth it, you owe it to yourself, you deserve it, be your best self, there's a duty to be beautiful. It's extraordinarily coloured in virtue and vice, right? That you're good if you do this, you're bad if you don't. And therefore, social norms, you can feel all kinds of pressure to do, but there isn't that pressure on the self, and nor do you think that they're going to deliver in the same way, right? You can evaluate a social norm and work out the costs of not doing it. Yeah. And sometimes you might think they're worth it. So social norms, like going out to work, for instance, right? Oh, if I go out to work, maybe some of the people on my street are going to think that, oh, she's a bit uptight, or she's, looking after her children properly, or whatever it is that goes with the social norms. And you can reason that out and say, well, that's not true, and I will be looking after my kids properly, or maybe I won't have kids, so that won't even be a consideration. Mm. Whereas a moral norm, built in is the condemnation and the praise, and you've already internalized that. So there's something, even though they often function in similar ways, there's something very different about how committed you are to it and how hard it is to reject it.
Right. I was thinking about the way morality relates to beauty in the culture, and I guess there's a kind of long history of morality and beauty being linked, but I guess what you're saying is a bit different. So I mean, I was thinking about, I'm reading Roald Dahl books to my daughter at the moment, right? So all the villains in Roald Dahl books are always ugly in some way, or kind of deformed or disfigured, or whatever. Same thing with Bond villains. And like the picture of Dorian Gray, the way the character of Dorian Gray, you know, his kind of moral dissolution is reflected in the painting with a physical kind of, you know, degradation or whatever. But I guess this is a bit different from that, right? It's not that your moral character is reflected in the way you look. It's that the way you look is in itself a part of the way you are morally evaluated.
Absolutely, absolutely spot on. So yeah, in our fairy tales, particularly in Disney's, particularly clear example, right, as well. And I had a great friend, James Partridge, who unfortunately is no longer with us, but who founded Changing Faces and Face Equality, and he was particularly angry about the way that orcs were portrayed with actual, you know, real facial disfigurements, as if we've sort of collapsed. So it is the case that in fairy tales, ugliness and evil have been connected, and goodness and beauty. And in fact, we really need to rethink the stories we tell our children. But those who are often in pre-visual societies, where the ugliness that was being talked about was the ugliness of the inside, the ugliness of the character. So yes, it was reflected in the outside, but we weren't supposed to read from that beautiful people are good people. We were supposed to read the opposite, that evil characters somehow manifest, and not always. So part of what's so evil about the Wicked Queen is that she appears to be beautiful, right? And then she's revealed. So it's always about the inner showing through, whereas we're now in a moment where that's completely collapsed, and where the being good is wholly connected to attaining the ideal, that if we're thin enough, if we're firm enough, if we're smooth enough, if we're young enough, that we will have the better life, by which we mean the better relationship, the better job, the better friends, and we'll have that thing that goes back to all beauty ideals, all the way back to the ancient Greek philosophers and Aristotle, that we'll be happy, we'll achieve eudaimonia. So there's a real sense that it's a, even though you can track some of the historical roots, there's something happening now that's very, very different, very different from what our parents would have imagined, or indeed any other ethical ideal, where the focus was wholly on the outside rather than either on the inside or as on the outside connected to something to do with the inside.
Right, yeah. Is that what you mean, or is that related to what you mean by our body has become ourself?
Absolutely, that's exactly right. The sense that who we are is somehow our body, and that what I want for myself is this better body, and not because I think that that alone will do it, but because it will deliver the better life. So when you look at New Year's resolutions, for example, it's now the case that nearly all of our resolutions are about the body. It might be eat healthier, it might be exercise more, it might be even lose weight. And we want those things. That's what we want. That's what we put our time and effort in. And if you compare that, so in the book, I look at some diaries of previous generations, and it will be things like, you know, I resolve to think before I speak, I resolve to be a better daughter, I resolve to be more caring. Right? These are all things that are bettering ourselves. They're either about improving our character, or they're about improving our knowledge, learning another language, or they're about how we interact. You know, I want to be kinder, I want to be more thoughtful. That's exceptionally different from I want to be thinner. Right. Yeah. Why would we think that, you know, firmer buttocks are going to make us better? Mm-hmm. And yet that's now so embedded into what people think. We almost haven't noticed that our value frameworks have shifted really profoundly. Mm. And we haven't, you know, been converted to this. It's sort of happened without us realizing. And that's startling when you look at it. It's really shocking. Mm. And yet it's just sort of everywhere.
Yeah. Okay, so we think that there's a serious problem here that needs to be addressed. But it's worth saying you don't think it's all bad, right? So the kind of beauty activities and kind of, you know, thinking about the way you present yourself isn't wholly negative and shouldn't be rejected altogether.
Beauty's positive and negative, and so much of the way we interact with people in our current cultural visual moment is around beauty, and we absolutely would not want to stop doing that. We are embodied beings. We relate to each other through our bodies. Our visual engagement is one of the first things that we see about other people, and philosophy has been really guilty as a discipline of forgetting our bodies. So much as I'm worrying about the harms, I'm also keen to recognise the positive aspects of beauty. We are not brains in a vat or the ghost in the machine. We are connected to our bodies. We live through and by our bodies. At times we are in need of other people to care for our bodies. And that's really important. And I talk in the book about some of the really positive things about beauty talk. Beauty talk is nearly always friendship talk. The right way that we interact and touch, lots of touching in our culture when it's not either sexual or medical is beauty touching. So I use the example of the old person in the nursing home when the caressing touch is often the hairdresser's touch, for instance.
Right.
And loads of practices we do together, from shopping together to are all beauty practices. So it's not the case that you can't do caressing elsewhere, but at the moment the beauty touch is one of the ways we caress.
Right. So to require people or ask people to throw that stuff out, they'd be throwing out quite a lot of stuff that's quite positive and nurturing as well as the negative things, right?
They'd be throwing out positive nurturing things, and it wouldn't work. It'd be impossible, because these are so much of the wonderful ways that we interact. It would be a really puritanical and really non-celebratory way to be human.
Okay. And so, and one of the things that you said, in fact, you've got a paper with this title, is that there's no duty to resist in this area. So, I mean, some people might be thinking, I guess, okay, well, if all this stuff is so bad, should I just be refusing to comply with any of this stuff? Should I be, you know, not wearing makeup? Should I be, you know, just refusing to think of myself in these terms at all? But you think that's not right, that there's no responsibility that people have to...
Not only is there no responsibility to do it, I think when you do that, you actually create lots of more harmful consequences. You divide women from each other. You actually end up just criticising other people. It's a very blaming and shaming way to behave. So I wrote that paper because I got really frustrated with the view that, oh, well, you know, if you silly women just stopped engaging, it would all be fine because we'd all stop caring about it. It's just so manifestly not true. So I think some of the thoughts about, oh, well, you shouldn't engage, were back from a very second wave feminism, back in the women's liberation movement in the 70s. And I think then there was much more sense to the claim, well, you shouldn't engage in wearing makeup, and because it was connected to other parts of being emancipated as women. It was like, oh, well, makeup's a private thing that you do for men, much like cooking in the home is a private thing that you do for men. Yet as we've won other goals, we've, you know, achieved equality, not equality yet, but we're on our way to achieving equality in education and employment and other things. When it comes to beauty, the opposite has happened. In fact, the more autonomy, the more power, the more women own their own money, the more beauty they do.
Right.
And it's not just rich women. The poorest of the poor do beauty too. So one of the startling things when I started working on this, I came out of a global ethics tradition, was when I found out that poorest women in the world swapping their antiretrovirals for skin lightening cream, you realise that this is not a rich white woman's problem. This is an everybody's problem.
Right.
And that's really important. When you think about, there's no duty to resist, there are lots of reasons why we don't have a duty to resist. One is that it hasn't worked. So maybe it stood a chance back when it was part of a larger project, but it didn't work, and we are a very long way from that. So why would we keep pushing something that we know doesn't work? Mm-hmm. Secondly, it divides women from each other. Those who do resist, they kind of look at those who don't as if, well, you bad non-feminists, why are you complying to some kind of male stereotype? And then those that do it look at those who don't and think, why on earth would you, you know, not make an effort?
Right.
You know, why, you know. And then it also relies on the assumption that people do beauty for men. And that argument is really difficult to make run in the current climate, where in fact men are doing beauty too, men are doing body work, men are aspiring to unrealistic body ideals. So all of those things that you're doing it for men, those arguments don't work. And the other thing that it does is it just draws more attention to bodies.
Right.
So if you're thinking about, oh, well, you know, I'm not doing it, I'm great, and then you see somebody who's obviously been doing body work, that does nothing to make you think about different ideals, to push back against the body as what's important. It makes the body far more important.
Yeah.
And just one more argument on this, that it ignores hierarchies of power. it doesn't recognise that it's much easier for some people to resist than for others. It's much easier for professors of philosophy not to wear makeup than it is if you're working in a bar or a shop, and it wholly denies that we're differently situated. So all in all, it doesn't work. It's unethical, divides women from each other. And we should just stop focusing on bodies and start thinking about other ways to address beauty norms.
Okay, so resisting these beauty norms is not the way to go. What about body positivity? So we often see, you know, things online about, you know, just trying to think more positively about your body and bodies that aren't, that don't kind of conform to standard ways of thinking about beauty.
Body positivity is really well intentioned, and for some people it works really well. So the last thing I want to do is knock those who do it and find it works well for them. But there are some serious problems with body positivity. So the first one is that when we teach it, we can be telling young people, right, you, first of all, you don't feel great about yourself, and then you've got the wrong attitude because you're not positive about your body. So we teach people they should be, and then they learn the language that they're supposed to say they are, but it can be a very silencing response because they still feel bad. They're just not allowed to say so. So right. It can actually make it worse. So that's my first worry about it. Okay. Another worry about it is the way that body positivity campaigns, especially when they're social media campaigns, they don't really promote diversity. They often address just one feature of the beauty ideal. So if the beauty ideal is thin, firm, smooth and young, then those that promote, for instance, the January campaign that encourages women to grow their body hair for a month, all of the bodies that then advertise that campaign are thin and firm and young, and they just have this small kind of piece of quite cute underarm hair. Mm. Well, that doesn't really push back against the ideal. It really reinforces it. It yeah. still talks about bodies, still very, very bodies that are very conforming, because you can trade features of the ideal off against each other.
Right.
So it's still reinforcing a dominant ideal. Similarly with yeah. fat. Right. Acceptance campaigns, often very, very beautiful women, still got curves in the right places, even if they're much bigger, and often very posed, very made up, almost pin-up style. So again, it's all focused on bodies.
Yeah.
It's not focusing on anything else, and it's conforming to 3 out of the 4 features. So there's a sense in which it thinks it's doing diversity, it thinks it's challenging, but actually it's reinforcing, because you're allowed to be a bit out if you're very in on other features.
Right, yeah, and it's almost as if being out on one of the 4 features almost kind of emphasises how in you are on the other features, right?
That's absolutely right, absolutely there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's really interesting. Okay, so we've talked about some of the things that we shouldn't do. So what should people do in order to try and kind of deal with these pernicious ideals that people are subjected to?
As a philosopher, I don't have any really well-tested answers about what we do, because we do need to address what is a harmful beauty ideal that is taking more and more of our time and delivering less and less happiness and well-being. But I can suggest a few things. The first thing we should do is be kinder to ourselves. So one of the reasons I'm so anti the kind of, oh, you should not do it, is because that's to put an awful lot of pressure on people who are already under what is an extremely dominant and demanding beauty ideal. It's totally rational to feel like you're not measuring up under this ideal. So the first thing we should do is just stop feeling guilty about what we do, stop feeling guilty about what we don't do. We should stop trying to see what other people do. We should just try and take the focus off bodies and stop worrying about bodies as much as we possibly can. Focus on other things. Then there are lots of things that policymakers are beginning to look at, what we can do around advertising standards, for instance. So often beauty products or cosmetic surgery will promise not to do this simple thing, which might be to moisturise your face, or perhaps to change the shape of your breast. Rather, they will promise to, you know, transform your skin, you know, make your skin, erase your wrinkles, right? Wrinkles are not erased, right? Or, you know, build confidence and self-esteem. So some of the things we can do are be just lots more of the laws that we normally have enforce them much better, right? If a treatment can't prove to do something, you shouldn't be allowed to advertise it. So there's all kinds of stuff around advertising that we can do. One of the things that I've done, and I've been working with the Anti-Bullying Alliance, is to think about how we can raise awareness that this is serious stuff. So I've been talking about lookism as appearance discrimination. So,
yeah, because could you say a bit more about that? So your suggestion is that we should think of lookism as an idea similar to racism or sexism, right? So kind of discrimination on the grounds of look.
Exactly. So just as sexism is unjust discrimination on the grounds of sex or gender, so I would like us to start thinking that lookism is unjust discrimination on the grounds of appearance. And then that's why I'm using it as a kind of, you know, when you say, oh, that's a lookist comment, I want that to be a wrong comment in the way that it's a wrong comment when it's a sexist comment. So I've started an everyday lookism campaign out of my work on Perfect Me. And in this campaign, people share their lookist stories anonymously on a website. And by lookist stories, I mean those kind of day in, day out body shaming stories that hurt people. They're not always meant to hurt people. They can be friends, they can be by family. And just as the Me Too stories or the everyday sexism stories provided a tidal wave that blew away some of the sexist practices, I'm hoping that gradually, if we raise awareness, we can do the same with lookism. We can use those stories to say, this isn't fun, it isn't banter, it isn't acceptable, it's hurtful, it stays with people, it stops them doing things, so that we can gradually have a change of attitude. At the moment, many people, well, they don't think about lookism. And if they do, they probably think, oh, well, you know, that's just kind of playground talk or office banter.
Yeah. Could you give us a few examples of those kind of stories that people have shared? Because I think some of them are quite powerful in sort of illustrating why this isn't a trivial matter.
So I'll try and remember them. I'll probably misquote lots of them. But the kind of stories people share are where somebody said, somebody will say something to them like, oh, my friend said to me that you've got such a pretty face, if only you could lose weight. And then they'll add to it, that stays with me. And I still remember it from 15 years ago. Mm. And the stories show it doesn't matter what you do. There'll be other stories that say you shouldn't be so thin. So there'll be one that's like, I met a girl that I hadn't seen for 10 years. And she said to me, oh, you've become so thin and not in a good way. And I remember that. And then you'll get it, you know, I don't like girls who wear makeup. If you wear too much makeup, you're fake. And then you'll get somebody else that was told, why aren't you wearing makeup? You haven't made an effort. And so it goes on. And lots about, you know, some that people think are joking. There are ones from husbands, from loved ones, from bosses. So, and some of them, other people might think are trivial. So there's some about, you know, the shapes of people's toes that meant they never wore sandals again for 15 years. Some about, you know, the shape of eyebrows, and the list just goes on and on and on. And the point of this is it doesn't matter who you are, you can now be body shamed for almost anything. And these comments stay with people. They make people feel bad.
And yeah, so no these are things that people are kind of are carrying with them, that, you know, comments that might have been made years ago, and which the person who made the comment probably immediately forgot and just has never thought about since, right?
That's what's so interesting. Yeah. Very little of it is nasty stuff. Mm. Some of it is, but an awful lot of it are throwaway comments that are done in fun. And I think if people were aware of how hurtful some of these comments are, then I think we'd just stop ourselves, especially given how many come from loved ones. Mm. And we do know that many cosmetic surgery recipients, not all, but many, will, when they go for surgery, report back that they were stung by something that happened to them early on, and that they've therefore always worried about that body part. And it is the case in some studies. So for instance, Kathy Davis's very early study of cosmetic surgery in the Netherlands, she was interviewing people who were seeking cosmetic surgery on the health service, and she says that she often couldn't tell what body part they were seeking to change, which tells you that so much of body shame isn't about how one might objectively look. Mm. It's about how one feels. And you can invoke feelings of shame by nasty comments. And that's why I want us to start thinking of lookism as just something we don't say, that it's not okay to say.
So what you want to do is to reframe the way people emotionally react to this stuff, right? So at the moment, there's a problem with people who are the recipients of these remarks kind of internalizing that as shame, and you'd rather that they felt angry rather than ashamed.
Yes. So when somebody says a sexist remark to you, you get a wolf whistle in the street, or they say something that's just blatantly sexist. Generally now, we don't feel, oh my goodness, am I wearing the wrong thing? Generally now we feel like, how dare you say that to me? And that's exactly what I want to get with Lucky's comments. At the moment, when somebody says something about us not looking good enough, we tend to feel bad about that, that we're not measuring up. We no longer feel like that about sexist comments. You know, the bum pinch in the office, we wouldn't accept that. We turn around and say, how dare you do that? And it's the rage. We need to turn shame into anger, and then we can say it's not okay. And part of what sharing the Lucky stories is to give us that collective thing. It's not you on your own that's been body shamed. Everybody, literally everybody, has a Lucky story. So even people who don't think it's important. So one thing that will happen to me quite often is if I'm in a public lecture is somebody will come up to me afterwards and say something like, well, you know, what will be, you know, worrying about next, you know, these are just things that people have to put up with. These are just hurt feelings. But then, and what's really interesting is they'll go on and tell me a story. So it'll be something else. They say something like, well, you know, when I was at school, you know, and that could be, you know, X years ago, I remember a teacher said this thing to me, but I didn't let it bother me because I knew it wasn't important. Right? And then you're thinking, but you've just told me a story that happened to you 30, 40 years ago that stayed with you and that you remember it. And maybe you think it shouldn't have hurt you, but it did, or you wouldn't remember it.
Yeah.
And of course, that was in a pre-visual culture. What happens now in a visual culture where everybody's judging themselves on how many likes they've had on Instagram, for instance, it's going to hurt even more. So I think it probably was a problem, but oh my goodness, it's a problem at a different level now. And we've got the evidence to tell us it's a problem because we've got this epidemic of body image anxiety. So anything we can do to turn down the heat, and I'm not for a minute thinking that if we stop people saying nasty things and body shaming, people are going to stop worrying about making the ideal body. But I do think if people were less afraid that they would be shamed, it would turn down the heat. So it wouldn't reduce it, but it would turn it down, because at least you wouldn't be called out and startled in that moment of complete vulnerability and complete self-consciousness as you are now when you're body shamed.
Right. And there is a clear parallel with, you know, the things you've talked about, like sexist comments and so on, because those comments like, oh, it's just something you have to put up with and, you know, don't complain about it too much. It's exactly the same kind of things that people used to say about that kind of comment, right?
So exactly the same. And this is also why I think I can help as a philosopher, because philosophers did help us name sexual harassment and sexual comments. So it used to be the case that those comments in the office were just treated as a bit of banter, that you were prickly, or you were uptight, or what's wrong with you? You can't take a joke. And naming that as unacceptable, sexist comments, sexual harassment, that completely changed how we thought of it. It completely flipped it. And once you can name it, then you can begin to address it. So that's why I really want us to name Lookism, and then to say, we don't have to put up with this. This isn't okay. And we gradually stop doing it.
Yes. But the other thing that you think we should do is to shift the shame onto the perpetrator, right? So currently it's the victim that feels ashamed, but you think there is a role for shame, but it's the people who are making these comments that should feel ashamed.
I do think that, but I think it's quite a long process. I do think there is a role, but I think it's quite a long way away. There's quite a long time till we get there. What I'm not suggesting is we go out and start shaming everybody for saying these things now, because of course everybody does it. And when you look at the stories, you can see quite clearly that very little of this is intentional. Exactly what you said about comments that people won't even remember when they said it. So first of all is raising awareness, and then if we get to the point with Lucky's comments where we are now with sexist comments, it's not like immediately people felt ashamed or we should be shaming people. Initially, we should be educating.
Right.
But now it's at the point that it's so rare to say blatantly sexist things in very many instances. So I'm not saying that they're completely eliminated, but for most of us in our workplaces, in public, those things are just not okay. So if somebody said it, they would stop themselves because they know it's not okay and they would be ashamed. So it's more about self-regulating.
Right.
But if it is so blatant in the way that now, if somebody says something really sexist, like say you're in an interview panel and somebody said, oh, well, we can't have her because she's obviously about to have a baby. Mm. She's just, you know, we're not employing women of reproductive age. Or, oh, well, you know, we don't want to have her because, you know, well, we know that women aren't as good as putting up with the criticism that she's going to get in this job, right?
Yeah.
The rest of the interview panel would turn around and go, you can't say that, right? That's not a reason. And so I do think there's a role, but it's not that I think we should wander around shaming people at whim now, and that has right. negative consequences too. But I hope we end up in a place where shame will have done its work and where it has a slight maintaining feature in the same way as it does with sexism now.
Okay. But should we call it out when we see it? If we hear somebody making a lookist comment, should we call that out and question them and challenge them on it?
I think it depends in the circumstances. And I think because what we don't want to do is immediately make people feel ashamed in that instance, but I think we should gradually educate. So there are instances where you should be calling it out. So one of the things that I'm doing is I'm working with the Anti-Bullying Alliance to come up with the training material for schools. And even though appearance bullying is the most prevalent form of bullying, we don't yet have effective training. So one thing we're doing there is we're using the stories to, you know, do work with teachers and then with students so that they begin to understand how it feels. Now, in that kind of context, in a context where you've got a whole school zero tolerance for bullying, once you've done all the education, then those pupils will begin to call it out.
Mm.
Right, they'll probably also go home to their parents, and when dad says something, they might say, dad, that's lookism, and begin to call it out in a kind of gradual educating way rather than a how dare you say that way. What we don't want to do is up the shame and the blame in either whether it's body shaming or whether it's telling people they shouldn't say that. What we need to do is gradually shift the shame such that we never say it because we'd be ashamed to say it. So it's a gradual spreading of the education process. So sometimes we should call it out, but given where we currently are, that needs to be at this stage in an educatory way, and eventually that shame will shift. And maybe at some time in the future, we will be calling it out in the way we do sexist ones because it's so rare and so extraordinary. And yes, you should know better.
Right. The other thing I was wondering about is, should we stop making kind of positive comments about people's appearance? Because a lot of the kind of ethical talk around beauty and beauty norms is actually positive, right? So we say, oh, isn't she doing well? Like about, say, an older woman, she still looks great for her age and all that kind of stuff. So is there a way in which even that positive stuff is still reinforcing the ethical ideal of beauty?
Personally, at this moment in time, I think to suggest that we go as far as not to talk about people's appearances would be really unrealistic. It's so embedded in our culture that it would be almost impossible to do. I also worry that we'd throw out lots of the positive things with the negative things. So I really don't want to get back to this view where we never talk about bodies because we're not bodies and we're all minds. And so much of our beauty talk, it is friendship talk. So, you know, when I meet a friend and say, oh, you look beautiful, I love your coat, and put my hand on her arm, right, I'm saying, probably, I love your coat, but more than that, I'm saying, you're my friend, I love you, I'm so happy to see you. Mm. So I think there's a real sense in which we should absolutely not think that any talk about bodies is problematic. There are problematic bits of positive talk about bodies, and some of those are becoming clearer and clearer. So I think in general, it's a good idea to stay away from comments about people's weight, unless you know that they are, you know, have chosen to lose weight and you're not worrying about triggering them and all of those things.
Right.
But when it comes to, you know, lots and lots of beauty talk, I think we should celebrate people's bodies. I think we should be happy when our friends are looking beautiful. And I think we should treat it as part of celebrating friendship and people and not worry about it too much. So I guess I'm saying, if in doubt, maybe, but for the most part, don't worry about it. I'm not trying to police culture at all. All I'm trying to do is remove this one little bit of really toxic behaviour that has deep-seated harms that lasts with people for a very, very long time. And if we just don't say negative things about other people's bodies, we could just stop that. But I am absolutely not trying to kind of silence any word about our bodies, or to in any way make people afraid to say really lovely things about people that they love.
Great. Well, I think we've pretty much run out of time. But before we finish, I just wondered, so you've got a book that's called Perfect Me, but is there anywhere else that our listeners should go to find out more about, you know, lookism and the beauty ideal?
If they'd like to join the Everyday Lookism campaign, then it would be wonderful if they could upload their lookist stories at everydaylookism.com. And if they want to know more about me and my work and they don't want to read Perfect Me, then if they visit heatherwidows.com, they can find many of my blogs and videos.
Great. So that's it. And Heather Widows, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of Ethics Untangled, please like and subscribe and recommend us to your friends. The podcast is edited by Mark Smith at Leeds Media Services, and our music is by Kate Wood. Ethics Untangled is brought to you by the Idea Centre, a specialist unit for teaching, research, training and consultancy in applied ethics at the University of Leeds. We offer master's programmes in healthcare ethics and applied and professional ethics, and PhDs, available full or part-time, and face-to-face or by online learning. We also offer consultancy and training services for business and the professions, including help with the difficult ethical issues faced by your organisation, commissioned research projects, and online or face-to-face CPD. If you'd like to find out more about these or any of our other activities, please visit our website at ahc.leeds.ac.uk/ethics.